are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, November 20th, 2017. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Vanderbilt historian Jefferson Cowie on the great exception, the New Deal, and the limits of American politics. Also on the program today, another woman claims being groped by Franken as the New York Times' Glenn Thrush is suspended during a harassment investigation. Or I should say, during harassments investigations. Meanwhile, Keystone Pipeline approved in Nebraska in the wake of a spill. They'll move it slightly. Republican tax cuts come into focus, and they look even worse. Mueller subpoenas the DOJ. That's got to be embarrassing at the commissary. Roy Moore challenged to sue Alabama.com website for its reporting. Meanwhile, Trump has found some new black athletes to disparage.
How to find those.
Mugabe entering guest who wouldn't leave zone.
The picture was taken with her willingly.
NOLA, New Orleans, that is, elects its first female mayor. And new poll shows Democrats want their party to move to the left. All this and more on today's program. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, we are just days away from... Yes, and she is progressive. It's a good, we got a good mayor in New Orleans. We'll see. I don't know much about that race, but I do know in the 300 years of that city's existence, never had a female mayor. So that's good. Everything else, not so great, but it's a Monday. We are a couple of days away from Thanksgiving. Just a reminder, we will have a show for you on Wednesday and a show for you on Friday. But on Thursday, we have decided that we're going to celebrate Thanksgiving. So the show will not be live on Wednesday, nor will it be live on Thursday. But it will be a new show with some great interviews. What?
Tell them what it will be?
No.
No?
I'm not going to give away the store.
Well, I didn't say recreate the interview now. I said say who it would be.
No. Why would you do that? It's going to be so good.
Oh, there you go. Everybody's talking about it.
Folks, everybody's talking about it. It's going to be great. It's going to be the best. The best show for you to listen to on your way home from Thanksgiving. Just a reminder, today... Tomorrow, Wednesday, will be the last days that you will be able to take our survey and help us. Go to majoritysurvey.com, majoritysurvey.com. Click on which one of those links describes you the best. Are you a member? In other words, do you have access to the member feed? Are you a free audio listener? Do you watch on YouTube? Those three options there. And you will click on that and you will fill out the survey and you will help us tremendously. This was an enjoyable moment when we now have most of the Republican Party apparatus trying to keep Roy Moore at arm's length. I think most of it is disingenuous. But whatever. I guess it's better than them not. The president, however, is being awful cagey, as exemplified by this visit of what's her name? Kellyanne Conway, right? Forgot her name already.
Oh, really?
I sort of did.
Playing.
I sort of did.
It's Kellyanne Conway.
It's like one of those things like where you say a word over and over so many times that you're just like, wait, is that a real word? Pear. What? Pear?
Namibia.
Yeah. It's just
Namibia.
Weird.
Namibia.
So Kellyanne Conway is on with Fox and Friends. Look, let me tell you something. If you can't get through a Fox and Friends interview about something without looking like you're trying to dodge it, you know you've got a problem. Here is Kellyanne Conway really trying not to say that the president and the administration is supporting Roy Moore.
Petty, partisan political reasons. And Doug Jones in Alabama, folks, don't be fooled. He'll be a vote against tax cuts. He's weak on crime, weak on borders. He's strong on raising your taxes. He's terrible for property owners.
So
and Doug
Roy
Jones
Moore?
Is a doctrinaire liberal, which is why he's not saying anything and why the media are trying to boost him.
So vote Roy Moore?
I'm telling you that we want the votes in the Senate to get this tax bill through. And if the media were really concerned about all these allegations and that what this was truly about and the Democrats, Al Franken would be on the ash heap of bygone half-funny comedians.
Half-funny.
He wouldn't be here in Capitol Hill. He still has his job. What's Bob Menendez doing back here? That's the best my state of New Jersey can do. Huh, Ducey? You live there?
He went to court.
Let me tell you something.
But the RNC has withdrawn support for Roy Moore. Mitch McConnell's withdrawn.
Hold on one second. Now, I just want to acknowledge that Ducey was like, "Hey, yeah, I am New Jersey." And
what's going on here? Kilmeade is like coming up on the rear to be not as stupid as Ducey.
It's not even stupid. It's just he's got one question. He keeps repeating it. Go backwards a little bit, and she won't answer. Go backwards just a little bit, and. Go ahead.
Let me tell you something.
But the RNC has withdrawn support for Roy Moore. Mitch McConnell's withdrawn support. So is the Young Republicans withdrawn support
for
Roy
Moore. And a lot of women.
And a lot of women.
Right. Yeah. And you know what? I just want everybody to know Doug Jones. Nobody ever says his name. And they pretend that he's some kind of conservative Democrat in Alabama. And he's not.
Kellyanne.
Yes.
Will the president be going back down to Alabama to campaign on behalf of Roy Moore before the special election?
There's no plan to do that. The president is going to continue traveling around the country on tax cuts and other issues. Yeah.
There you go. Wow. So she won't say it. Now, incidentally, this Doug Jones, soft on crime, was a prosecutor who... successfully prosecuted some KKK terrorists who...
Not that crime.
Not that kind of crime.
No, I meant like tough on crime. Not like
that
soft and liberal.
That crime, subcrime in quotations, was committed against black children.
I meant tough on crime, not politically correct.
There were some bad guys on the other side too.
Yeah. You had the children in the church doing very bad things. You had the guys planting the bombs doing very bad things. Okay? Very. It's complicated on all sides. On many, many sides.
But you know it's bad if Kellyanne Conway can't manage to snow the Fox and Friends.
You also know
trio.
It's bad when I'm considering that there was like a 0.05% chance that Brian Kilmeade is actually genuinely unsettled by the idea of a pedophile in the Senate.
Oh, I think you're wrong.
I said 0.05% chance.
I think he
which
was
still
just,
would mean a 99.05%.
I think he was just
he
supposed
care.
To say something. That's what I got this in my mailbox today, and I was supposed to say this 5 times. I did it.
And Ducey's like, it's really confusing without Roger. There wouldn't be any questions like that. It would just be like, those bitches are bitches, right? And then I get a bonus. It's
and
a confusing world
we're both
now.
From New Jersey.
We're both from New Jersey.
All right.
I get a bonus?
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Jefferson Cowie, author of The Great Exception, The New Deal, and The Limits of American Politics. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Professor of History from Vanderbilt University, author of The Great Exception, The New Deal and the Limits of American Politics, as well as the incredibly well-acclaimed Staying Alive, The 70s and the Last Days of the Working Class. Jefferson Cowie, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
So let's start, just forgive me for one second, let's start there with, let me reading a quote of yours from your book. To reframe the New Deal order as a great exception, I must emphasize, is not to take a jaundiced view of American history, but rather urges a more thorough and realistic understanding of our recent past in the hope that it can provide a more stable intellectual foundation for discussions of present and future politics. So that is your mission. Let's start with the question as to why, what was the New Deal an exception of?
Great opening question. Okay, so the idea is that, broadly conceived, the period before the New Deal and the period after the New Deal order, so we're talking about roughly the 30s to the 70s, kind of look more like each other than does that period from the 30s to the 70s. And I really look at the social foundation of politics. So in terms of the way individualism worked, in terms of the way religion worked, immigration, race, all these key, and of course labor, all these key questions reconfigured in the New Deal and post-war eras in such a way that it created a more cohesive politics than we see before or after, which makes progressive politics a more complicated thing for the future, and the New Deal less of a good, less of a solid metaphor for how we think about the future.
All right. Well, let's dig into those aspects that, I mean, I guess, so you have these elements that led to, I guess, the opportunity for what was a bit anachronistic in the context of American political foundations. But let's go to those political foundations. Let's tell us about that sort of, I guess, the individualism, the mean. If we're returning to the mean, reverting to the mean, let's right. talk about the mean.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, if you think about what divides politics today, right? What are we arguing about? We're still arguing about the culture wars, about religious values and proper behavior. We're arguing about immigration. We're arguing about individualism, individual rights, both a left-wing version and a right-wing version, as opposed to collective economic well-being. And all of these things, and, you know, politics is highly racialized, obviously. So all of these things are the drivers and, most importantly, the dividers of American politics. It was Henry Adams back in the end of the 19th and early 20th century who said that politics is the systematic organization of hatreds. And I think that a lot of those things were suspended or mitigated, really. Not suspended, but mitigated, lessened enough for a more cohesive politics to emerge in the 1930s and 40s that really kept going for a couple of generations. So think of it this way. It's sort of a, you know, informal law of political science that more homogeneous societies tend to be more social democratic, right? So you look at Northern Europe, that's where you see the most homogeneous societies, and you see more social democratic traditions. For a little while, we were a little bit more homogeneous, not necessarily in good ways, but because, for instance, we had a very racialized immigration exclusion in that period where we didn't fight about immigration. We basically excluded it. And so these things created a much more cohesive polity that allowed a foundation for more collective politics.
Let's dig into those things that created that cohesion. That first thing that you mentioned was a change in our immigration laws that was a couple of decades before, maybe three or four decades before the New Deal. Tell us about that and what.
Right. Well,
Go ahead.
Well, the Johnson Reed Act in 1924 essentially racialized immigration and closed off what had been unrestricted immigration from Southern and Eastern Europe. And we've been fighting for decades. I open the quote with a quote from Ben Franklin all the way back, you know, in the 18th century, complaining about, you know, the darn Germans just aren't like us. And, you know, those Lutherans, I don't know what to do with them. Or can they really be Americans? And we've been having that fight all the way up until for the first time we really restricted immigration in 24. When the crash happens, when the economy falls apart in 29 and Roosevelt comes to power in 33, for the first time we have an economic crisis where we're not blaming immigrants, where we're not dividing over who's an American. Everybody's here, and you have kind of this, we're all in this together, everybody's a citizen, and we move forward. I mean, that's a simplification. Like I say, everything I'm talking about is really a mitigation, not a switch that goes on and off. But basically, the tensions around immigration are gone. And then it doesn't open up again until 65, when immigration reform happens after the Civil Rights Act. And then by the 70s, and certainly by the 80s under Reagan, we're fighting over immigration and who's a citizen and who has rights and who doesn't and all that kind of stuff.
You also suggest that religion, there was a mitigation of, I guess, the force of religion in the country at that time.
Right. So the Republicans in the Gilded Age in the last half of the 19th century called the Democrats the party of Romanism and rebellion, right? So Romanism because they were Catholic, Rum because they were, you know, they believed in that we should be able to have a drink, and rebellion because they were connected to the Southern, white Southerners. But that Romanism and then later Judaism, as in the 1890s and into the early 20th century, Jews began to come to the country in large numbers, really divided the country. But with the mitigation of immigration, and then with a sort of the invention of this new thing called a Judeo-Christian tradition, we have what religious historians call in the post-war era a religious truce, where we kind of, as long as you believe in God, we don't care what it is, which shows you're not a communist, it's fine, right? So we're not really going to have fights over what kind of God and who and you know where you go to church, as long as you go to church. So that religious truce in the post-war era again makes the politics of religion less salient than it was before, or it is obviously now.
But what about in prior to the New Deal, that would have sort of again, I guess, mitigated those forces that would otherwise prevent a New Deal?
I'm not sure I got that question.
Well, I mean, you say that, you know, with the beginning of the onset of the Great Depression, mm-hmm. You were talking about religious institutions were sort of overwhelmed, mm-hmm. and therefore they did not have necessarily the sway over people that would in some way function as an obstacle to the New Deal.
Exactly. Right. So not only was it not an obstacle, but in fact, what happened was at the beginning of the crash, people turned to their religious institutions, their community-based institutions for help. But the crisis of the Depression was so big, the crisis was so profound, that those were exhausted quite quickly. And so people began to think, oh, we need help somewhere else. And that's when they actually began to turn to the federal government and endorse Roosevelt. And it's interesting too that Roosevelt begins to play a little bit of a secular religious kind of figure as people are putting his picture on the mantle at their homes, and he sort of has these fireplace chat type sermons. I think he actually plays a kind of secular priest in a way throughout the 1930s and early 40s.
Where was the race factor here in terms of, I mean, because, conceptually, right, we're looking at these specific, obviously, the Great Depression is the primary factor. But
right, yes.
How
the huge rupture.
How the Great Depression was also sort of short-circuited these other political forces is what we're talking about, right? In terms of which allowed the the response to be to the Great Depression one thing as opposed to another.
That's exactly right. So, and which is not to say the other wasn't out there. I mean, you had populists like Father Coughlin, you had America Firsters, you had, you know, you had all, you had communists, you had all sorts of people who were vying for position in this crisis. But what allowed for this sort of mild social democratic tinge to American politics to solidify, I think, is just such a fascinating question, and one we tend to presume rather than ask. So the number of I guess what I'm trying to say is all of those things are there. They were there before, they were there after, but the New Deal had enough power, enough to triumph over those. And that's when I say that it's mitigated, not sort of an on-off switch for these other factors. And now race is the one you raised, and that is by far the most complicated issue, I think, in American politics and in my book. Politics was very, very racialized, obviously, based essentially on racial exclusion and the creation of Jim Crow, and the Democratic Party was very complicit, obviously, in Jim Crow in a variety of ways. Come the 1930s, you see this really interesting balancing act where the New Deal is passed, but in order for it to pass, you need to essentially exclude African-American occupations. And we don't really think about this enough, that in order to get the Southern congressional delegation to vote for the New Deal, you essentially have to exclude people who work in agriculture and service work, and because they don't want to empower African-American people in the South. So it requires this massive compromise, this essentially an exclusion, the creation of a false homogeneity in the sense that, okay, well, we're going to leave this huge hot-button issue off the table for now. And I think it essentially that's why you see the major eruption 30 years later with the civil rights movements. But at the same time, the New Deal is also encouraging a certain amount of black participation. Roosevelt has his black cabinet, and Eleanor is out there sort of making links and between the White House and African American groups and things like this. And so one commentator at the time said that the Democratic Party is carrying water on both shoulders in terms of the race question. Both excluding and including. And it's a balance that could only last a little while until, rights really began to come back to the forefront in the post-war era.
So conceptually, as we're looking at this, there are we have a major catastrophe, right? And we certainly...
Which one are you thinking about?
Well, I'm thinking about the Great Depression. We'll get to the catastrophes of our modern era in a bit. But
that's what I wasn't sure whether you.
But I'm just trying to, because, and your thesis is that the normal, I guess, the pre-existing and the sort of like underlying foundations of American society are such that were it not for the suppression of those three elements at that time, we would not have been able to get the New Deal. Was there something about the suppression of those elements that allowed the idea of mild social democracy, as you say, to filter through as opposed to other things? You know, like, I mean, if I'm imagining all these things waiting at the gate. And, they're all different shapes. One's a square, one's a circle, one's a diamond. And it just so happens that the things that sort of peel away from the gate create a diamond. And so the diamond passes through. But what was that it? Or was it that there was a specific impetus that was just pushing and they were lucky, or as opposed to it being, there's plenty of examples of when usually other countries, and usually we're involved on one end of it, where there's a catastrophe and we move in and privatize the hell out of it or whatever it is.
Right, exactly. Well, if you actually look, you know, the Great Depression is not the only economic catastrophe in American history. There's a depression in the 90s. There's one in the 1870s, 1890s, and there's a panic in the 1830s. And we, of course, know the 1970s in our own time. And in most cases, capital gets the upper hand, right? Business gets the upper hand in those crises. But this time, in the 1930s, working people did. Regular people got a leg up. And the question is, why? And I've never really thought about your metaphor of sort of like the shape is passing through the right hole, but I do think that's sort of what happened. Now, this you're raising a kind of a complicated historiographical question, which is what's the connection between earlier types of reforms and the 1930s? So in the past, we said, oh, the Progressive Era, Theodore Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, that's a dress rehearsal. Like, we got our engines running, and then we really took off in the 1930s, right? But my argument basically says that stuff was its own thing, and it had it not been for the Great Depression and World War II, which really doubled down on the role of the state in American society. Without the Great Depression, I don't think you would have seen this major burst of reform. You know, one way I often go about this is saying, who was vice president under Roosevelt? In the first term, nobody knows. It was a segregationist Southerner, Texas Jack Garner, Cactus Jack Garner. And, you know, had Roosevelt, for instance, not survived the assassination attempt on that happened prior to him taking office, that's who we would have had as president. And I can imagine a very different scenario. So you also have, you know, very specific individual circumstances playing in this, in addition to these large demographic and political transformations.
And is there more evidence of your thesis after this era? We go through what some call the Great Compression. Is there more evidence of this notion that this was a sort of, I guess, obviously a once in a lifetime. I think we've more or less established that. I mean, there may be a couple of older people around, but more or less a once in a lifetime change. Why isn't, let's say, the Great Society or like, you know, that era, why isn't that equivalent?
Well, I think it's part of it. So, it's what we call the New Deal order or the New Deal, you know, era really goes from the 30s through the 70s. That's how that's when the political coalition of, you know, workers and liberals and white Southerners and minorities all work together in a very specific coalitional form. So when Johnson takes office, he basically sees himself as fulfilling the legacy of the New Deal. He is a New Dealer. He has a kind of a different outlook because he's in a booming economy, not a shrinking one. But he's part of that fabric. And even the civil rights workers are part of that fabric. But I think that's we're on a very different footing come the 1970s. I mean, if you think about something like, you know, individualism. Herbert Hoover gave a speech called Rugged Individualism right before the crash happened. And then Roosevelt came along and said, hey, we're all in this together, right? And then World War II said, we're all in this together. And the Cold War said, we're all in this together. And then in the 70s, you have this revival of individualism, both a Reaganite version and then a new social movement version where everybody demands rights on, you know, from a position of, you know, gender or race or sexuality or whatever it is, but it ends up sort of being a rights-based, individual rights-based claim, and on both bookends to this, you see a much more virulent form of individualism, I think, at work than you do in this interim.
And I mean, had we seen this on the left? I mean, I've seen some critiques of that return, that blossoming of individualism on the left. The hyper-normalization, Adam Curtis's documentary sort of, you know, talks about this phenomena, particularly in the context of sort of artists in New York, and people sort of trying to create an individual a sense of individuality as being right. the most sort of freedom. Was there other history? Was there other examples on the left of this prior to the New Deal era? I mean, I can definitely see it on the right. It's nice to have individual rights if you're a robber baron. Was this on the left? You know, that sort of like, good.
You mean prior to the New Deal?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It was more of a mixed bag. I mean, you have, say, if you have somebody like, you know, maybe your listeners have seen, Reds with John Reed, the old movie about John Reed and, you know, the village at the time was full of sexual experimentation, individual artistic expression and all this stuff. But it was also a time where socialists and communists and all this were alive and well and engaged in a variety of questions. And they were not as mutually exclusive a terrain, I think, as they are now. I think, the big debate now, I hesitate to even bring this up, but between identity politics and class politics we see today and the massive divide we see on this, I think is indicative of kind of where we're at today, in which the virulence of this kind of individualism is still powerful. It is very powerful.
But where does that emanate from on the left? I mean, if there was a... If there was at least an example or an indication that these things could coexist, and in fact, some would argue, look, living in a socialist society will give you more opportunity to pursue creativity. Well, I mean, how did it split off?
That argument you just made is the one that progressives need to make, that there is more freedom involved in economic security than there is without it. That you will have more latitude and more freedom if you have health care. You can be more entrepreneurial. You can do anything you want if you're not wedded to your job for health care. You know, I think that's a little sidebar there that I think is really important, and I really like the way you put that. But I think if you look at the success of the 30s and 40s, it really was around a collective agenda. It was about, unionization and the National Labor Relations Act and the Social Security Act and the Fair Labor Standards Act and all the stuff that provided a secure economic platform. If you fast forward, the major breakthrough of the 1960s was the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, right? And that provided the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission and all the stuff that protected individual rights to participate in society, which is a really important breakthrough, because the problem with the exceptional period was it was exclusive. There weren't immigrants. It was largely for white male industrial workers. It excluded African Americans. They needed to make those claims. There's absolutely no doubt in my mind those claims needed to be made. The question is now, how do we get back to having two conversations at once? One about redistribution and one about recognition and participation. And having both of those conversations now is where we need to be, because I think the post-60s, post-70s a framework has really been about recognition, and that's been really important, but now it's time to really begin to go back and weave back in the old questions of redistribution in the way the 30s and 40s did.
Now, I know we're starting to move slightly out of your portfolio as a historian, but I mean, you write in your book that this is from your, I can't remember the specific words, but it was something to the effect of, from my political perspective, this is something of a tragedy, in that we will not be able the shape will not be the gates will not fall away in such a way that this shape will be able to head through again. So what is, I mean,
that's right.
So let me just, with that said, and just, I don't want to harp on this too much, but when this individualism crept back up, right, and it was in service of in basically fulfilling a debt, essentially, that society owed, right? We needed to to pay off these debts we had accrued in terms of not bringing everyone aboard during the New Deal. But did it necessarily have to then increase the sense of individualism on the left subsequent to that? Or is that just sort
of... No, not necessarily. I mean, if you track, say, where King was going with the Poor People's Campaign in 68, and economic questions were really boiling to the forefront of the civil rights struggle, I think, you know, or you say Cesar Chavez bringing together, you know, union power and Chicano civil rights, or you know, the hospital workers in New York, or melding soul power and union power. There were a lot of possible linkages. But the way it broke by the time the 70s came along and really restricted economic opportunity in a very different way than the 1930s, right? I posit the 70s as sort of the anti-30s in a way. We saw a much more restricted version. We began to compete more for individual rights, to compete in this shrinking world of employment. And that's what sort of, I think, helped turn things sort of nasty. Rather than having the discussion about how do we divide the pie, we had a discussion about, okay, we can get, let's make sure everybody can compete for a slice. And I think that proved to be a bit of a dead end. But it's not to say that lots and lots and lots of people were not trying alternatives, right? It's just what won.
Right. And so if you're explaining this story to us so that we can have a better sense of our history, so that as we look forward, we have a better sense of what it would take to, if not recreate that type of situation, but to enhance the opportunity for change. What now? If the idea is that this is who this country is, and we just went through a 40-year long period of, you know, an accident of fate on some level that we can't recreate, I would say, well, I guess my second question, and then I'll ask it first, is, you know, what do we do about that? But before we get to that, do you think that's the case with race as well? I mean, because certainly as much as we are defined, as you argue that we're defined on some level by sort of our roots in individualism and in, you know, this, I guess all the forces that would prevent collectivism and all that entails, we certainly are as equally rooted in subjugation of people that we deem at any given time to not be of the majority or of the power of the elite. And yep. We've made some progress there, although, you know, it's
always surprising how little sometimes.
Yes. And, you know, I mean, I think I've come to see it as a continuum, and, you know, there's ebbs and flows. Hopefully we're making a couple of steps forward, but I mean, there's an argument that, you know, we're not as forward, we're not taking many steps forward as it might appear at first glance.
Right. And I think that's even more complicated by the fact that I think when the state, and when I say the state, I mean mostly the federal government, but the whole compound state from local and state and federal government, is mobilized in terms of social rights and social welfare, it becomes almost immediately racialized. And this goes all the way back to Reconstruction. When the federal government did something, it appeared to be doing it on behalf of black people, right? And this is mythology, but this is what it appeared to be to the white majority. And so there's always been this fear that somehow black people are going to get something out of the federal government that white people aren't, even though, you know, the federal government is largely a subsidy to middle-class people. So when the New Deal comes along and blacks are excluded, then you have this great leap forward, right? Now, after the 60s, again, politics becomes much more racialized. How do we integrate people who are, as you say, long overdue in what stake they should have in this society? We fracture politically along those lines, and people begin to fear the state as a means for African-American people to advance, or immigrants. And so it's so messy and so complicated. So that's my answer to the race question. But I think we are. I mean, as bad as things can be in terms of questions of race and power and incarceration and police shootings and all the horrible things, it is essentially illegal, technically, to discriminate in this country. And that's an important thing to remember that this country's achieved. It may seem like small change, but I think it's really, really important. But the flip side of that is, you know, now you might be illegal to discriminate, even though not to say discrimination is eliminated, but it's illegal. It's almost impossible to organize a union. That's where we have a legal right, but in practice, it's almost impossible, right? So we have this kind of ironic twist now where in the past you could organize a union, but we largely excluded African Americans. Now we're trying to, as a society, find ways to include minorities, but we've eliminated collective economic rights. And I think the path forward, which is the origin of your question, is to find out how to have a conversation about both things at once. And that is a tricky thing, both inclusion and redistribution, because obviously inequality is the big issue of the day, I think.
Right. Now, I would say there's also, I mean, I think there's an analogy between the idea that we have outlawed discrimination from, you know, for most people.
Yeah.
You know, obviously, we still have some LGBT issues, but I would also argue that just like it's legal to start a union, and there has been enough sort of like process inhibitions to, you know, bars. There's been a lot of bars to entry, let's say, to making that happen. There's probably a good argument that we've done the same thing in terms of race, right? I mean, you can look at like wealth and income disparities and really start to say like, whoa,
right.
You're not allowed to discriminate, but it sort of feels like somehow this didn't happen by chance.
Right. Exactly. So, that's why I think we really need to keep our eye on the questions of economic inequality in this. And within the question of economic inequality, you know, you might be able to redistribute it to the so-called working class, but it's got to be the full mosaic of working people as well, right? We too often think white working class is the working class, but of course it's not. It's black people, and it's gay people, and it's women, and it's immigrants, and it's, you know, it's the most complex group. And the labor movement as it exists today is probably the most diverse institution in America, but it's shrinking.
So will this change, do you think, happen because certain obstacles will be mitigated, or will there be forces that are arrayed that overwhelm those obstacles? In other words, you know, in the 1920s, we inhibit immigration and it creates a more homogeneous country in some respects. And therefore, you know, anti-immigrant sentiment is not an obstacle to real change. I mean, it seems to me like we can't go that direction and get there anymore,
right?
Even if that was, I mean, I wouldn't want to, but even aside from that, I don't think that we can go that direction. It almost feels like we have to go the opposite direction. Like we have to overwhelm those fundamental pillars that exist in the undergirding of the American body politic to get past that stuff.
Exactly. I think we have, and that's the message of the book, is that this is this New Deal, which a lot of us, including me, look to as this really great positive breakthrough in American history, was that. But it's a bad metaphor, a simplistic metaphor for the future of American politics. So where does that leave us? It leaves us with a very long, difficult struggle to work through these, you know, foundational issues in American history and politics. And it, I think if there's a single message, is it's going to be tough, that it's a lot easier. The conservative victories seem a lot easier, and liberal and left-wing victories are that much more difficult, and if you take this argument seriously. And therefore, you know, actually, I think there's a certain hope in that, right? Like, okay, this is a tough struggle. There's some real issues at hand that need to be dealt with, that are ingrained in the very DNA of American politics, and they have to be dealt with. And you need to think tactically and strategically in a way that incorporates that into how you think. And you, if you want to dig through the American past to find better eras, if you need a metaphor, a historical metaphor, you might look at the Progressive Era, the era between 1901 and 1917, the age, this period of great reform of a very, very different type than the New Deal. They had its own problems, not the least of which was racism. But I think the way politics worked at that point was much more shifting, coalitional, kaleidoscopic. You know, it might, any given agenda might include this set of people from a cross-class alliance, and then this other issue might include this other group of people. And that it was worked in a much more sort of fluid and dynamic way, whereas the New Deal created this block of interests and politics that lasted for two generations, whereas the Progressive Era is much more kaleidoscopic, and I think it fits more with our own time if we want to think about it that way.
The book is The Great Exception, The New Deal, and the Limits of American Politics. Jefferson Cowie, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Had a great time. Thanks, Sam.
Bye-bye. All right, folks, going to head into the fun half. This guy's down at Vanderbilt with their phones. A little scratchy. We'll try and clean that up maybe for the podcast. Folks, just a reminder, this show exists only because of the grace of our members.
It's a great point.
Just gave this like weird grunt.
Just giving you a grunt of affirmation.
Yeah, I know. Point. It's like it was like the first time you've heard it, as opposed to like literally the 1400s.
Well, time. I think I was trying to make it new.
Okay,
that should be our new podcast for men: is grunts of affirmation.
Grunts of affirmation with Michael Brooks and Matt Leck. Single payer healthcare.
Jesus.
Like left wing Tim Allen.
That's right.
That sounds terrifying, but potentially very lucrative.
New character.
New character.
Now you're going to have to go and watch.
Now I have to actually watch that, which is disturbing. I've managed my whole life. Wait, is that actually the noise that idiot made?
That's part of it, but that's not the famous one where he's grunting about his power tools.
No, that's the one they put at the end of the show.
Oh, is that really? Oh my God! Jesus, I'm sorry.
Isn't
folks.
The only reason
I feel like we just lost members from this whole exchange?
Isn't he like a rat too? On top of everything else,
oh, he's horrible.
Like he's a no, but I'm saying like he literally the only interesting thing about Tim Allen was that he was involved in like an actual drug ring before he was in show business. Look it up. He was involved in like he actually moved coke. He actually moved coke, like for real. And the reason he's not in jail is I think some kind of plea bargain. So I think in addition to being a Trump supporter, I think he's also a rat.
Yeah, I mean
he's just the worst of all worlds.
Wow. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, no honor amongst the
dude. Well, you're trying to speak up for rats now?
No, I'm not going to. I mean, listen.
Now I know where you have stories in your background.
Look at
stool pigeon. Like, I'll flip on a dime for all of them. Somehow. They were all selling drugs, and it wasn't me. I was forced to
use. Nothing like
see?
Those mean streets of
Northampton,
Mass.
You got to keep it tight
where
there.
Just,
There was a lesbian granola smuggling ring.
You never crossed the guys from Pittsfield.
Actually, Pittsfield does have some things going on. That was the wrong city to use.
I remember being on the campus of Amherst, and yes, I was exactly. always very concerned. Folks, just a reminder.
You know what? The campus.
Excuse me for
be
1 second,
for a
Michael.
Lot of abuse.
Please.
Yes.
Just a reminder. It is your membership that makes this show possible by becoming a member today. You support the show, and then as a bonus, we give you extra content every day. For instance, and content sometimes it's like almost impossible to ever get your hands on, no matter what. Like, for instance, like Wednesday and Friday of this week, we're going to be doing deep archive stuff. So it could go way back. Who knows? Maybe we should let Jamie and Brendan just take a look and see what excites them. In studio, Eagles of Death Metal?
Oh, no.
No? How about the They Might Be Giants?
Oh, that sounds fun.
Well, what about... all right, never mind. She's not...
You're missing the grunts
Cowboy
now,
junkies.
Aren't you?
Cowboy
man.
Junkies. In studio, Cowboy Junkies. Hunting.
Who are they?
Seriously?
Yeah, seriously. I mean, only I kind of vaguely know who they are because you mentioned them a lot.
There's a beautiful song. I can't remember what the song was, but it was about... it was an anti-war song. So, I remember they said there was two of them. They sang it in the studio, and I was just like, oh, my God. Because I never get moved by anything that...
Right.
Nothing.
That's great.
Nothing ever moves me, and I found it very moving. All right. Well, look, we'll see what it is. I'm not going to promise anything now. Forget it. Nobody's excited about any of it. Don't forget. MR Holiday is the code to get 30% off your Just Coffee, folks. Free shipping. 30% off your coffee. If you are smart, what you will do is you will buy a ton of coffee, literally a ton. You can get 5-pound bags. I don't know, can't do the math on like what it would take to get a ton from 5-pound bags. Somebody?
No.
We have like 15 producers working in here. Nobody can do the math or find it. How many 5-pound bags would it take to get a ton of coffee?
400.
400?
2,000 pounds.
There you go. All right. Thank you, guys. So now's the time. If you ever want to buy a ton of coffee, do it now. 30% off at justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. You have 30% off the MR blend. Are you kidding me? Also, don't forget, tomorrow night, the Michael Brooks Show. Two shows.
No, like peace, victory,
oh, right.
Yes.
Here we go.
Wait, that wasn't a grunt. That was like a throat.
I don't have to do... I can do whatever sound I want to do. I don't have to do
Dr. Christopher Ryan on and Adam Proctor on a Marxist strategy to defeat the alt-right. And then Bree Joy Gray is in the post-game for patrons.
All right, folks. See you in the fun half. 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920 is the number. We will take your IMs. See you in a minute.